First case is Coalition for Secular Government versus Scott Gessler in his capacity as Secretary of State. Are both parties ready?
Yep.
A few housekeeping matters. Argument is set for an hour, half hour aside. The petitioners, you have to keep track of your own time. And when you argue, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And secondly, I want to let everybody know that some of us use iPads. And we have all our notes and briefs and links to Westlaw on iPad, on our iPads. And so we're not surfing or handling emails. It's just so you know. Okay, let's begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Alan Dickerson of the Center for Competitive Politics, appearing on behalf of Coalition for Secular Government. With me is my colleague, Tyler Martinez. This case is about political speech. At issue is whether Colorado's extensive regulation of political advertisements may, on the basis of a single sentence, be extended to regulate lengthy philosophical, historical, and political writings, specifically a 20,000-word policy paper. This court is asked to address this issue in the context of four questions certified by a federal judge as part of an ongoing lawsuit brought under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. The first pivotal question.
Could I ask you real quick?
Of course.
I had a little trouble from reading the certification. So what's the nature of the lawsuit in the federal court?
The nature of the lawsuit is that a number of provisions of Article 28 are unconstitutional, either facially in the case of the major purpose test, or as applied in the context of other provisions.
So this is a declaratory judgment, basically?
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And did I, and is there a request for injunction too, or?
There is a request for injunction. The injunction, to give you a little bit of background, the injunction request, CSG filed for a preliminary injunction. The court consolidated that to a trial on the merits of the 30-day trial schedule. And then when the relevant issue did not make the ballot in Colorado, certified the questions to this court.
I see. Okay.
Going back to the CSG 33-page paper with 176 endnotes, the question is whether it may be classified in its entirety as express advocacy. Both parties agree that a single sentence of that paper contains express advocacy. And both parties agree that absent that single sentence, the paper would be issue speech exempt from regulation by the state of Colorado. There are three principal reasons why this court should find the paper is not express advocacy. First, under the rules announced by the U.S. Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo and Massachusetts Citizens for Life versus FEC, it was and is unconstitutional to require a group engaged in genuine issue speech to register as a political opinion, and the voters are presumed to have known this. Second, the voters of Colorado, in passing Amendment 27, intended to regulate advertisements, not substantial academic work. And third, this court may interpret the state constitution to avoid absurd results. To regulate this paper as express advocacy, a result that, to our knowledge, would be unprecedented in the modern history of the Republic, would be an absurd expansion of the principles of Amendment 27.
Could you address our case of Colorado Ethics Watch and how you see that relating to this first issue?
Colorado Ethics Watch?
Yes.
First century?
Yes.
Our view is that Colorado Ethics Watch provides a very useful roadmap. This court, slightly over a year ago, unanimously held that in the cannabis speech context, express advocacy must be limited to express words of advocacy, namely the footnoted words in Buckley versus Vallejo and its substantial equivalence. But the court also procedurally said a couple of interesting things. First is that the issue is the opinion of the voters and the intention of the voters in passing Amendment 27. And second of all, in determining the intention of the voters, it is appropriate to look at constitutional law in effect in 2002 and to assume that the voters intended to use terms in the ways that they would have been understood under the laws that existed in 2002. As we noted in the briefing, in our view, that means that the law that governs this case is MCFL and Buckley. And whereas I'm very happy to discuss and distinguish later Supreme Court decisions that occur in a very different context, I believe this court was correct when it unanimously noted that McConnell and Wisconsin Right to Life, and I would argue by extension Citizens United, arose in such a different context to provide no useful guidance here. On that point, and again, following Senate Majority Fund, Buckley versus Vallejo very clearly carved out a distinction between issue speech, which may not be regulated in any way by the state, and discussion of candidates and, by later extension, ballot initiatives, which may. Buckley is oftentimes misunderstood. It's famously understood to say that the Federal Election Campaign Act could be saved from overbreadth and vagueness concerns by reading expenditures in connection with an election to mean expenditures, to mean communications that expressly advocate for the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. What is less often noticed is that the Supreme Court undertook the exact same tailoring analysis, the exact same savings analysis, in the context of disclosure. At page 80 of the opinion, the court very clearly states that because of the privacy rights and the associational liberties associated with issue speech, the genuine discussion of political issues, no amount of disclosure or registration can be required for genuine issue advocacy. That is a theme that has been kept consistently to this day. Even McConnell, a partially overruled decision, which probably marks the high water point of state regulation of speech, explicitly says that the interests of the state in regulating speech, including, I would argue, in disclosure and registration context, cannot apply with the same force to genuine issue speech. So to come back to this paper, the question before your honors is that we assert that the paper is genuine issue speech.
Mr. Dickerson, what do we do with that last sentence? How do we deal with it?
Well, I think there's a few approaches. The first is to say that when the people passed Amendment 27, they had an idea of what express advocacy looked like, and that is the MCFL brochure.
Why would they not have believed that the express advocacy meant the magic words in Buckley footnote 52?
Right.
I think they would have, in the sense that.
So how do we? I mean, you put yourself in our shoes. How do we write that?
Well, I'd be happy to, Your Honor. I would write it as follows.
Yeah.
I would say that, first, there's simply, the government does have a burden here. We are talking about a case that implicates the First Amendment and implicates equivalent privacy and speech rights under the Colorado Constitution. And to read Amendment 27 so broadly, in the absence of any evidence that the people intended to regulate things other than advertisements, would be an absurd result. And with looking at Buckley anticipated this problem, and I think this court can rely on Buckley. Buckley said, and I actually have the quote here because it's one of my favorites, that the distinction between the discussion of issues and candidates will dissolve in practical application. That's a fairly famous quote that I'm sure your honors are familiar with. But it goes on to say that not only do candidates campaign on the basis of those positions, but campaigns themselves generate discussions of issues. That goes both ways. It's not only that issues and the discussion of issues can implicate candidates or ballot initiative elections. It's that the fact that there's a candidate, or the fact that there's a ballot initiative, can in turn prompt people to discuss the issues of the day. And if there's going to be any safe harbor, if there's going to be any room for issue speech, then if Buckley's to mean anything, it must be that you cannot have this trap for the unwary where a single sentence that happens to include magic words automatically includes the whole.
We're trying to push you to come up with some sort of test, though. I mean, is it, if 99% of the piece is issue speech and 1% is express advocacy, we treat it as issue speech? I mean, I'm trying to figure out what your test is for us when we get something. How do we determine whether it's issue speech or express advocacy?
Yeah, I mean, the magic words are there, so what do we do with them?
I would say,
I mean, you put them in there, not us.
Certainly. First, I would say that while I understand this court's concerns, there will be difficult questions, and this isn't one. And the reason that it isn't a difficult as applied issue is that the court can easily bracket this. MCFL provides a baseline, and I would argue that anything north of MCFL, in terms of its indicia of issue speech, as opposed to its indicia of political advocacy, express advocacy, is issue speech, which is protected by the broad grant in Buckley.
Where is that line, though, in MCA? Where do you want us to draw that line? Or where do you think the line is? And I understand you think this falls below it. Where would you draw the line?
I think that's a difficult question to answer, Your Honor.
Well, and that's exactly why I think her question is so very important, because otherwise we wind up with a decision just like the Tenth Circuit decision in Samson that refuses to establish a line and creates a lot of chaos in terms of enforcement on the Secretary's side and compliance on advocate's side. So help us, please.
I guess I respectfully disagree with the premise.
Okay.
I think taking your point on Samson, Samson dealt with your standard run-of-the-mill political advertisements. If it's not political advertisement, it's not clear to me that any of this law, any of the state's regulations and interests attach. So the difficulty with Samson wasn't that we don't understand whether the speech was or not a political advertisement. It's about the characteristics of the committee. Here, it's about the characteristics of the speech. And precisely because the reason this case looks so difficult at first glance is because there's no precedent. But there's no precedent because no government entity has ever attempted to regulate an extensive policy paper or a book or anything similar as a political ad based on a single sentence. And so again, with deference to the need for a bright line, I think the bright line is MCFL. It's that if you look at the four corners and there is expressed advocacy, and there's all these other indicia that show that the brochure as a whole was expressed advocacy. I mean, it's not just there's one sentence in MCFL. It's titled Everything You Need to Know to Vote. There's a clip about coupon on the back saying, take this to the polls. I mean, yes, there is a vast gulf between the MCFL brochure and the paper issue here.
But doesn't this paper here, the proposed paper, I'll stick with this question for now. I have many more. But this paper itself, the one that was posted in 2010, refers to the 2010 ballot initiative, according to your opposing counsel, something like 70 plus times over the course of those 20,000 words.
That's correct.
And so it's very clearly about that particular ballot initiative and the fact that there are 35 pages of explanation why we arrive at the conclusion that one should vote against the particular proposed ballot initiative. Doesn't mean that it's not, in fact, just a very lengthy advertisement.
Well, it's one that probably nobody is going to read.
I read it.
I'm being halfway facetious.
No, and I think that's fair, Your Honor.
Your thing about advertisement is that it's geared at advocacy. This is geared at analysis. It almost looks like a quasi-law review article, except it would be heavily edited.
It's probably more rigorous than your average law review article, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, maybe. But don't we have to have a concern about picking up other kinds of magazines, articles, even law reviews where stances are taken?
Well, as we pointed out, I think the Supreme Court was concerned about this in their hypothetical, the 800-page book with a single sentence. But I guess there's a few points. Sorry, I'm now trying to address two lines of questioning.
You're being pushed pretty hard there. Do we look at it and see if predominantly it's advocacy, not advocacy?
I think this is a facial question, or not a facial question. This is an as-applied question. This is a question certified.
It comes down to the test. That's what everybody's really asking. How are we going to figure this out?
The test is anything that, looking at the entire document, is issue speech, is genuine issue speech, just because it contains some diminished
amount. So we look at the penumbra?
I think Colorado has been very wise in avoiding that type of argument. I mean, in some ways, Justice Marquez, I think the issue, in my view, that sort of analysis is putting the cart in front of the horse. The reason we have the express advocacy definition is to form a protection around issue speech. But of course, that definition, that protection, came out of a particular statute that regulated ads. So in the context of an ad, if you've got a 30-second ad and it says vote for, vote against, whatever else, that's a substantial percentage and portion and thrust in, you can't use an intent test, but it's there on the face, of what that ad is doing. If you were to apply, and the court applied that same type of analysis in MCFL and said, let's look at the overall thing and, let's make sure there's words of express advocacy. But let's also, the question is whether the overall publication is express advocacy, not whether it contains one or another words. You know, and MCFL, again, is the closest case that has ever been litigated on this question. And that was an 8-page brochure with consistent references to voting, with consistent, you know, references to the ballot box, with consistent... There wasn't any issue speech in the MCFL world. So I guess, in terms of drawing the line, it's really anything that is issue speech is outside the purview of the state's regulatory powers. And MCFL is the most extreme example of something that can be regulated. And I hope that answers your Honor's question.
I suppose that this is an appropriate juncture before we move to a different topic. Could you perhaps explain to us the party's position on what appears to be the apparent mootness of this issue, the fact that there is no pending ballot issue or question, and why this court should wander into this topic?
Because Wisconsin Right to Life 2, which dealt with a mootness issue, very explicitly said that the fact that an election has passed does not moot under the capable of repetition yet avoiding review doctrine.
So and you view it as an exception to mootness?
It is absolutely a well-established exception to mootness in First Amendment cases. And also on the record, I would point out that my client intends to continue publishing this paper. So I mean, the capable of repetition part is not just capable, this will be repeated.
But the document that's before us in the record is not a document that is proposed to be tendered, in other words, proposed to be published. This is simply the one that happened to be published in 2010. Is that
correct?
Correct? So we don't know exactly what is proposed to be published in some future context.
Well, what is proposed to be published is a publication that is substantially similar to the 2010.
With the magic words?
With the magic words and everything. And I would point out that, you know, Judge Kane in Federal District Court certified these questions right after learning that there would not be a ballot initiative. So I would think that at least in federal court, the danger that this will be viewed as moot is minor, given that I assume the district court is conscious of certain realm you're talking about. If there are no other questions, I will reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Grove. I'm here on behalf of the Colorado Secretary of State, who is the defendant in federal court action. Certified questions are generally presented in the abstract, but as we've seen in case after case, and I think as the opening argument here demonstrated, context almost always matters. So I'd like to spend a couple of minutes at the outset describing in a little bit more detail how we got here and what's at stake in the federal case. CSG is a small ideological organization and also a Colorado nonprofit corporation that has a range of interests, ranging from commentary on current events to philosophical discussion. As its name implies, and as the complaint of the federal case alleged, it generally advocates for individual rights and for the separation of church and state. CSG, and this is what distinguishes this case from MCFL and a lot of others, has embraced modern media and communicates with its constituents primarily through the internet. It has a blog covering a lot of topics. It also releases podcasts, radio sort of broadcasts that are available on its website. You can just go to the internet and listen to them. As an organization, CSG has taken a particular interest in the persons of the women. And in 2008 and 2010, its principals wrote and published a policy paper that underlies the central issues in this court and in the federal case. The title of the 2008 paper was Amendment 48 is Anti-Life. Amendment 48 was the personhood amendment in 2008. Why it matters that a fertilized egg is not a person. The 2010 paper, which was a revised and expanded version of the one published in 2008, was titled somewhat more broadly as The Personhood Movement is Anti-Life. Why it matters that rights begin at birth and not at conception. For reference, just in case you haven't seen it, the 2000 paper is on the CD that the U.S. District Court submitted. It starts on page 35. Because it raised a couple of $1,000 specifically to compensate the authors and to pay for things like layout and printing and distribution, CSG registered as an issue committee, as required by Article 28 of the Colorado Constitution, in 2008 and 2010. In advance of the 2012 election, the proponents of the Personhood Amendment again gathered signatures to try to qualify for the ballot. CSG decided that it wanted to update and publish the paper again. But rather than register as an issue committee, CSG filed suit in federal court, arguing that Colorado's registration and disclosure requirements were either unconstitutional, inapplicable to CSG, or both. The certified question is addressed really the second question here, whether the registration and disclosure requirements are inapplicable to CSG.
Because of Samson, right?
Because of Samson and the arguments that they don't encompass express advocacy or that they qualify for the press exemption. The proponents of the Personhood Amendment did not submit enough signatures to qualify for the 2012 ballot. That took some of the time pressure off. And by the way, Justice Marquez, I agree with Mr. Dickerson that there's probably not a mootness concern here because...
there's probably not one.
There's not a mootness concern here because the federal court is going to decide, at least Judge Kane's indicated that he's going to decide whether the federal constitutional questions that CSG has presented whether they presented a valid claim under the First Amendment or not. And so the threshold question then is what's been presented to this court, and that is whether Amendment 27 applies to CSG's activities at all. And so if they don't, that would move the federal court case, but reaching those questions is probably necessary in order for the federal court case to go forward.
And on that topic, I'm particularly interested in how that relates with respect to the fourth question, meaning the impact of Samson. I certainly understand what are the potential state law issues with respect to what constitutes express advocacy under Amendment 27 and whether this is a written communication and so forth. But the impact of Samson, I'm having trouble understanding how that's a question of state law that's appropriate in this certified question context. And the reason I ask that in particular is because obviously Judge Kane as a federal district court is bound by the 10th Circuit ruling. This court, however, is not. And so I'm a little bit confused as to why Judge Kane would turn to us to ask us what the impact is and whether that has any impact on Judge Kane at the end of the day.
I've gone back and forth as to whether this court should actually answer the fourth question or not. And what I will say is that this is not the last bite of the apple that this court is going to have on Samson. And in fact, I can talk about it in a little bit, or I can talk about it now. There's another case that's pending on the circuit at this moment.
It's the same issue, right, Mr. Grove?
Essentially, it deals with the Secretary's administrative authority, but it will actually present a more square opportunity that has facts in the administrative record.
Let me just tie that, because I'm particularly troubled by that fourth question as well. But the Tenth Circuit, as I read that case, it dealt with the federal constitutional right of freedom of association as applied. So how and in what way is you're shaking your head. Is that wrong?
As applied is the big question there.
Well, it was pretty clear to me the way they balanced it. Isn't that what they really were saying?
Samson was presented as an as applied challenge, certainly.
No, I'm talking about the opinion.
Yeah, and that's the difficulty. Is some of the language in Samson is extraordinarily broad. And there's nothing in that opinion that, especially if you contrast it to the district court opinion in that case, which was very specifically, and I think in my view, very clearly limited to its facts. Mm-hmm. The Tenth Circuit blew that wide open. And some of the language, for example...
But wait a second. We're really talking about the federal interpretation of the First Amendment to get back to Justice Marcus's question, right? That's what freedom of association is what that case is about. We can maybe say is it as applied, but certainly wasn't facial ruling, right?
I think the question is the extent to which an as applied ruling can have a facial effect.
Okay.
And we've certainly seen that in other cases.
But we're talking about federal constitutional right, right?
That's right.
So how does that relate to here what we have to do, and as well as the case that we have that's pending cert?
Assuming that Samson is an as-applied challenge that essentially has a facial effect, and that is the Secretary's position, then the impact that it has on Amendment 27 and the reporting threshold, which is set at $200 by the Colorado Constitution, is essentially facial. If Sampson is taken to say, it said in that case, $2,300 is well below the line, mm-hmm. then our position is that any issue committee that spends less than $2,300 will be well below the line for the purposes of the 10th Circuit's analysis in the future.
Now, was that? Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, was that part of their holding? It sounds a little bit to me like what you're saying is, although they decided this as an as-applied challenge and it only applied to their case, if you look at their reasoning, they're likely to do something in the future with regard to a whole class of cases. Is that pretty much what you mean by it has a facial effect?
I would say it's more than likely, Your Honor. The Tenth Circuit panel opinions are binding on the remainder of the court, and I think that any similarly situated plaintiff, and by similarly situated, I mean one that spends less than a couple of thousand dollars, would be basically in the same boat that the Sampson plaintiff was.
What was the nature of the case Buck Sampson? Was that a declaratory judgment?
It was.
And what did they declare? They didn't enjoin enforcement of anything in Colorado, right?
Not specifically. But
they exempted, didn't they, Mr. Grohl?
I'm sorry?
They exempted the registration, so it would be an injunction.
What they held was that it would be unconstitutional to apply the registration and disclosure requirements to an issue committee that was specifically to the Parker North Annexation Committee. Our position is that the breadth of the language that the court used is, well, I mean, it led to this case, for example. One of CSG's arguments is that they don't spend enough under the precedent set by Sampson to qualify for issue committee registration.
But in their estimate is $3,500, correct?
CSG's estimate in this case is $3,500, yes.
So why does this, the question that's up on the case on cert, why is that different from this question?
First of all, it has an administrative record. Certified questions, although we do have a record here, it's fairly thin. Mm-hmm. But what we have in the CCC case that is on your doorstep is an administrative record that establishes the Secretary's reasoning for why CSG, we believe, creates a gap in the law, why the $5,000 threshold that the Secretary selected was appropriate in light of not only the opinion in Sampson, but a survey of other states and how they treated it in other circuits. I mean, Sampson has been fairly roundly criticized by courts in the Seventh Circuit, the Second Circuit. It's faced a lot of difficulties in other circuits, but be that as it may, the CCC case, when it comes up, will have a better record than this one presents. It'll allow you not to, the issue with, I think, answering the question in this case, I think one of the difficulties that I've perceived is that if the Sampson Court was right about anything, it was right about its decision not to draw a bright line. I don't think that's a judicial role. That's something that either the legislature or an administrator such as the Secretary of State should do. And so it's obviously up to you whether to answer the question. After looking at it, I'm not certain that this is the right case to do it.
Thanks.
So I guess we've already answered the Fourth Circuit question. So let's get back to the beginning. And before turning to the others, I just want to emphasize one more item that I think can get lost in the shuffle sometimes. CSG's federal lawsuit is about disclosure. It's not about direct restrictions on speech, contributions, or spending that's related to ballot issues. That's important, and I disagree with Mr. Dickerson on this point, because as in Citizens United and Doe v. Reed and a whole host of other cases, both from the U.S. Supreme Court and federal circuits have held, regulations that require disclosure are generally favored and are subject to a lesser degree of scrutiny than regulations that generally limit speech and directly limit speech. So with that background in mind, let's talk about the first certified question. And the first asks whether the paper qualifies as express advocacy under the definition of Amendment 27. That's important because if the paper does qualify as express advocacy, then money that is spent on it qualifies as an expenditure. And under certain circumstances that I think everyone agrees are applicable here, would require CSG's registration and participation as an issue committee. I think that CSG's position on this question can be boiled down to two central arguments. First, that Amendment 27 was never intended to capture communications like the paper that are lengthy and thoroughly researched and that don't look like an advertisement. And two, that because the paper contains very few magic words relative to its length, it would be unreasonable to hold that the entire thing qualifies.
So what's the test?
Our position is that the test was established by Senate Majority Fund.
Well, what is it?
If magic words appear in a communication, then
that's it.
That communication is express advocacy.
I just want to get this clear. The word vote dooms the entire thing. That's your position. There's nothing else in the paper that dooms it. It's just the word vote.
Well, Buckley's footnote 52 said vote for or vote against.
Okay, it's a vote. You got two words.
And so, yes, the answer is yes.
Well, the election is in there, too, as I recall.
And I don't have the whole laundry
2010.
List. I don't have the whole laundry list of what was in Buckley memorized in my head, but I do remember vote for and vote against. And it's and the actual words that are used are very important. That's why Buckley introduced them, and that's why in Senate Majority Fund, this court adopted previous Court of Appeals precedent that said those words were substantially similar sentences. And so I think that when you get to something like whether it's vote instead of vote for or vote against, then you might be able to start to look at a little bit more of the context. That does raise some questions as to whether it's a substantially similar synonym. But if it is one of the magic words.
You're done. You're done. And the reason I ask that is you're not making a contextual argument at all on this paper. You're not going through the paper and saying, it seems like an advertisement, or it seems like express advocacy. You're basing it purely on vote.
This is exactly why Buckley came down the way that it did, and this is exactly why this court, in my view, came down the way that it did at the Senate Majority Fund. The main concern in Buckley, at least when it came to issue committee or political committee registration, was that people who wanted to engage in political speech would not be able to tell whether the speech that they were about to make was going to be regulable or not. And the test that the plaintiffs in this case have proposed raises exactly that the same specter that the Buckley Court was concerned about. What they're encouraging is this court or an issue committee that's about to engage in speech undertake a contextual analysis and say, well, 99.9% of this is not really express advocacy, but we do have this one word, but, well, it kind of looks like a law review article, and so we don't think that it should be, but then you're going to have an organization that opposes them, they're going to sue them, much like we had in Samson, they're going to incur attorney fees, and because there's not a bright line test that they were able to rely upon, they're going to then turn around and raised a challenge that said, well, we had no idea whether this was express advocacy or not when we started. And so the whole advantage of relying exclusively on magic words is to take away the specter of vagueness and overbreadth. And that's completely consistent with
But that's what exactly what puts you into the problem. Now, you know, the law reviews, I'm going to stand up for the students here a minute. They're going to these blog, online, you know, readable things rather than ones that take 2 years to get out in publication. And there are going to be some opinions expressed about specific issues that they're analyzing. And, you know, given the internet age and the op-ed kind of thing, or journalism, you know, there's a kind of journalism now that isn't just reporting facts, obviously, it's taking a point of view. So, isn't the sweep of your argument incredible? I mean.
Well, there are a couple of issues there. First, you're skipping a bit into the press exemption.
Yes.
And if we're talking about something that is a law review article or something like that, then it appears in a periodical, and that would be exempt regardless. The second issue is the compensation or the expenditure part of it. If this is somebody who is just posting a blog entry or something like that and is doing it on their own time and isn't requesting money or having funding coming in for it, then they're not required to disclose in any event because there's no expenditure, there's no spending of money involved. And so I think that the sweep of our position is not quite so broad as you'd be concerned about for that reason.
Could I ask one question? And maybe I'm making a distinction that's not really involved in the case, but does does your opponent's argument seem to ask us to make a distinction between what is permitted, what Amendment 27 could do under the First Amendment, and what they actually, what Amendment 27 intended to do, and whether not just, I mean, I thought I hear them saying in their written materials, not arguing at all that this is express advocacy in some small part, but that Amendment 27 hasn't imposed a disclosure requirement on all express advocacy that it could, but only on certain kinds of documents, let's say, and that kind of document should be defined by the amount of express advocacy it has.
I think that they're asking the court to reach that interpretation, yes. And it's based largely on, at least my understanding of the briefing, is that it's based largely on what the Blue Book did and didn't say, and what the preamble to Amendment 27 did and didn't say. This court should really only reach those questions if it decides that the plain language of Amendment 27 is ambiguous. There's a lot of precedent that establishes that you look first to the plain language. And the plain language is very clear. Section 10, I think, or Section 2, paragraph 1, defines issue committee, and it defines it as an organization or a group of two or more people who, A, spend more than $200, and B, on express advocacy, and B, have a major purpose of engaging in express advocacy at an organizational level. And whether or not the preamble or the Blue Book explicitly discusses lengthy policy papers or small amounts of money or the types of ads or the type of communication, the plain language sweeps all of those into issue committee status. So I don't think that, yes, I think that's the argument. But I think this court's constrained by the plain language.
And would it be fair to say then your interpretation of that then is the plain language of the amendment itself indicates that it intends to treat everything that could be treated as express advocacy, everything that it would be able to require disclosure of as express advocacy, that it has done that?
That's true. And you know, I should add one more thing. Of course, if the plain language results in an absurdity, then that's something that this court could then, I think, take a step beyond and start looking at the Blue Book and the preamble and any other extraneous materials. This isn't absurd by any means. This is not a trap for the unwary. Senator Dorfman says that if the magic words show up, it's express advocacy. That's very easy. It's a bright line test that's simple to apply. And as Justice Marquez pointed out, and as the briefs point out, Amendment 62 shows up, I think, 76 times in this opinion. In the paper. It's very clear if you read it what it's about. And certainly there are some educational components, and certainly it is designed to attract an audience that may not be particularly interested or swayed by a 15 or 30 second ad that flashes up on your screen during the evening news. It's designed for a more intelligent reader who has a much more in-depth and longer attention span. But the fact that it takes a different format should not relieve CSG from having to comply with the fact that they are intending to sway voters by engaging in that type of electoral advocacy.
Can you help me understand, though, just building on that point? If it takes a different format, then how does it not qualify it under the press exemption?
So CSG has taken, I think, they've advanced three reasons why it should qualify for the press exemption. First, they say that it qualifies as a standalone opinion or commentary writing. Second, they claim that it's periodical. And third, in the reply brief, they suggest that it actually should be considered part of the blog, that it's an adjunct to the blog, and it should be considered one of the articles that the blog includes. So let me go through those one by one. On the first point, the press exemption does not just apply to opinion or commentary writings standing alone. It applies to opinion or commentary writings that are, and this is a quote, printed in a newspaper, magazine, or other periodical not owned or controlled by a candidate or political party. If we construe the press exemption to include standalone articles such as this one, it would cause two problems. First, it would violate the cardinal rule of construction that every word and phrase that's included in a statute or constitutional provision has to be given effect if possible. And here, adopting CSG's position would read the second part of that, published in a newspaper, magazine, or other periodical, completely out. Second, broadening the press exemptions in this manner would allow the exception to swallow the rule. Virtually anything could be construed as an opinion or commentary writing. Now, it might not extend to something that, you know, a yard sign that said, vote against Amendment 62, but we start to get into a gray area if we say, if we have a yard sign that says, vote against Amendment 62 because it is a really bad idea, or because it is the only moral choice. So it would be very easy to craft a communication in a manner that avoided the press exemption entirely if this court were to hold that an opinion or commentary writing standing on its own could be considered, could qualify for
press. Yeah, but another canon is if we can avoid the constitutional question by construing the legislature's intent. And, you know, only print journals qualify for that press exemption?
I'm sorry?
Only print journals qualify for this press exemption?
I would say no. Our position is that a blog certainly would qualify for the press exemption. Okay. That's consistent with what the FEC has said.
So we still have to look at the overall intent and impact?
Well, when you're trying to tie what we've got into, when you're trying to tie the paper into the blog, then that raises a separate question. And
how so?
Well, the question is the paper actually, can it reasonably be considered part of the blog? And that gets into some of the facts, which I think that the record that we have here actually adequately demonstrate. And those facts, the facts that militate against this are as follows. One, CSG perceives of and acts to publish this paper as a completely separate endeavor from what it normally, from its normal course of business. Its normal course of business is publishing a blog, writing op-eds and having them published, doing a radio podcast. And all of these are available on the blog. But it doesn't raise money separately to do any of these things. So that's the first thing. It actually, for the paper, it engages in a separate fundraising appeal that says, if enough people contribute and we can raise enough money, then we're going to publish the paper. If not, then we'll just maybe do it the next time. So that's what happened in 2008 and 2010. Second, the paper itself is distributed in a manner and looks different than the blog does. It's actually published in a separate PDF format, where the blog is, you know, it's normal inline text that you would see in a blog entry. It has a different format, it has pictures, it has a very professional layout, things like that. The blog, everybody has seen the blog, they know what that looks like, and this does not look like, you actually have to link to it separately, it's not published as part of the inline text. And so, for that reason, I think that it's, and this is from a different era of media, certainly, but I think that it is comparable in some ways to the special edition that was the source of the controversy in Massachusetts Citizens for Life. That case involved a regularly published newsletter. It was somewhat irregular, but you know, it was three times a year, five times a year, eight times a year, depending on what was going on. And then a special edition that was had a completely different distribution model and was formatted differently and had different content than the remainder of what the organization's normal publications constitute. And so, that's the analogy that I would draw here between whether the CSG public policy paper can be considered part of the blog. Or answer would be no, and the analogy for that would be the MCFL.
Can you just go through the steps one more time for me? Your argument is that we start with the blog, and how is the article connected to the blog? It's a PDF, a separate PDF, is that your argument?
I thought you said it's a link.
It's a link,
and I would encourage the court just to go to the website and take a look. It's linked in the briefs, but all you do is you go to the blog, and there's a link to it, I think, in the upper right-hand corner, and you can download it as a PDF paper.
Okay, so that's what, in your opinion, takes it out of the press exemption, because it's a link, not actually part of the blog.
That's correct. And it's a fine distinction, but we have to look at what the normal press activity is. And if we consider the normal press activity to be publication and updating of the blog, this project is different. And it's not just how it's linked, it's also the fundraising issue. And that may actually be the more important thing. It's very clear that CSG perceives that this is a separate endeavor than the normal blog. If they raised money for the blog and said, we'll publish a blog every year, and then this happened to be part of that fundraising endeavor and they linked to it separately, I think our argument might be somewhat different.
Could you walk us through the argument about the written communication? I was a little confused by how what's being asked of us plays into what's going on in the federal district court action.
Mr. Dickerson can probably give you more, can probably shed more light on this, but I will give you what our position is. And that is that written or broadcast communication, that's defined, it's actually not defined, but it's contained in Amendment 27's implementing statute. And it's at 145.03, sub 12. And the General Assembly passed that in the wake of Independence Institute versus Kaufman, which was a case that dealt with whether the A major purpose test that's contained in Amendment 27 is vague or overbroad. The intent of the statute was to codify the test for determining whether an organization has a major purpose of engaging in express advocacy. But the legislation, by its own terms, was not intended to change anything. That's very clear in the statute itself. And it certainly wasn't intended to support any interpretation that would say a paper that contains 20,000 words of writing is not a written or broadcast communication. I just don't think that those two things can be squared under the argument that CSG presents. So that's probably the best I can do for you. You may want to follow up on that with Mr. Dickerson. But our position is that the paper is a written or broadcast communication because it's written. Unless the court has any further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Clove. Mr. Dickerson, above.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would start by saying that, well, a few things. One is that this court need not reach questions 2 through 4 if the paper is not express advocacy. But having said that, I think the Secretary is on the horns of a dilemma. On one hand, it says that the words $200 in the Constitution are sufficiently vague that this court may act to interpret them. But on the other hand, all of this infrastructure about whether or not express advocacy applies to a lengthy paper, which has never been litigated or considered, and for which there's no evidence that anywhere was the intention of Colorado voters, is clear on its plain language. I don't necessarily see those as consistent arguments. To the extent that this court is swayed by the idea that there's no ambiguity in the monetary trigger, I would think that would substantially strengthen CSG's points on the other issues. I also like to agree, in a sense, with the Secretary that Senate Majority Fund is the standard. But Senate Majority Fund sets out a necessary but not sufficient standard. It is true that the state may not regulate speech unless it contains express advocacy. But it doesn't mean Congress. The reason that limitation exists, going back to Buckley, is to protect issue speech. It is precisely to ensure that the state only regulates express advocacy. And I would argue, going back to Justice Ives' point, that you must look at the entire context. You must look at the entire communication. Otherwise, well, what does NCFL stand for? I mean, NCFL is a case where Justice Brennan walks through and doesn't just say, look, there's express advocacy, we're done. There are paragraphs of analysis going through and looking at the entire communication to see whether or not it contains the sort of issue speech that Buckley very clearly protected, including the fact that Justice Brennan cites to the section of Buckley that talks about registration and disclosure. NCFL was wrongly argued, if nothing else. If courts are not required to look at the four corners of the document in an attempt to rescue or to save or to protect genuine issue speech. And again, this is a strain you see through all of the cases. And I think this court was correct to recognize the necessary but not sufficient need for express advocacy in Senate Majority Fund. But that does not save courts from their obligation to search the entirety of the record, to search the entirety of the communication in order to protect genuine issue speech.
So give me the standard. What burden does the state have in this case?
The state has the burden of proving that a communication or writing contains more express advocacy than genuine issue advocacy.
Preponderance standard?
Not necessarily a preponderance standard. I would say it actually cuts the other way, in the sense that because the purpose of these tests is to save issue speech, unless I'm going to borrow somewhat outside, because again, this has never been litigated because no other state has thought to claim a limitless principle like this. But I would borrow somewhat from Wisconsin Right to Life, the concept that if a communication can be interpreted as something other than an express advocacy, can be interpreted as issue speech, if a reasonable person looking at the overall communication would say, yes, this looks like issue speech, then it should be exempt from registration by the state. And I believe that that is a task that courts can do, a task that courts have done. The court did it in MCFL. The court is being asked to do it here. I can't think of other examples because, again, the Secretary is not arguing for any limiting principle. Forget this paper. Take the hypothetical from Citizens United, which wasn't a banned context, but that's relevant. Take the 800-page book. If a resident of Colorado, in conjunction with a co-author, writes an 800-page book, which includes one sentence of express advocacy, and we don't even know whether it has to be a concluding sentence or not, we don't know where it has to be. If a character in my novel says vote for or against a particular candidate or issue, does that qualify? No one knows. And it cannot have been the intention of the voters of Colorado to create that sort of absurdity. And I do not believe that the equivalent risks rest in the other direction, because again, MCFL provides a baseline for government regulation. Sham issue speech that contains express advocacy may be regulated. And that's very clear from the court's analysis in MCFL. So in conclusion, unless there are any questions on any of that, I would simply say that the case appears difficult because there's no precedent. The case appears difficult because this has never been attempted. What we know is that the need for express advocacy comes out of the need to protect genuine issue speech. That is its purpose. And to say that it is necessary for state regulation does not mean that it's sufficient for state regulation. And it's been the consistent view of the Supreme Court, and I would hope the consistent view of the voters of Colorado, that the regulation is extensive, heavily footnoted, clearly academic work. It is not suddenly thrown into the problems that Buckley identified on the basis of a single sentence.
So it has to be some sort of effective communication to move people. So it's got to be short, it's got to be compact, it's got to be a 30-second sound bite,
advertisement, pages.
A yard sign, or what?
It can be 8 pages that is, you know, with clip-out coupons in the back and various other initiatives of express advocacy. But I think your Honor has consistently, in this argument, been getting at something very important, which is that, you know, the government interest has been, all of these cases are around ads. And in ads, the need for disclosure makes a certain amount of sense. If I click out an ad that says, my organization likes this particular issue and thinks you should vote for it, well, okay, why should I take your word for this? Who's funding this? What are your interests? I think it points out the ad hominem element of disclosure in many contexts, right? It's not just what is being said. It's not let's evaluate the speech on its merits. It's who is saying this so I can use that as a proxy. But that interest doesn't exist in a 33-page research paper. The paper speaks for itself. There's no need to look beyond a heavily done piece of academic writing to figure out what it means. And so the interest of the voters in the disclosure and the registration of someone who's just putting out ads, which may or may not be misleading, which may be all these interests that have been identified as potentially problematic, how do you import that to a long paper or a book? If I publish an anonymous book about Colorado politics, with someone else, do I have to register with the state? Of course not. Because the book can stand on its own. You can read, my 33 pages, and you can look up my 175 footnotes, and you can figure out what I'm saying and judge it on its own merits. That's not necessarily the case with political ad. And I think this goes back to this question of what do the voters intend. The voters intended to regulate ads. Go back to the Senate Majority Fund decision, which this court decided unanimously, a year and 2 months ago? And there, it consistently refers not to writings, not to communications, but to advertisements. This court has recognized, just as the preamble, just as the blue book, just as every other piece of evidence in this case is recognized, that the intention is to prevent this issue of people going out, coming out with ads, and the voters having this informational interest. I would submit,
And this is somewhat beyond the scope of the briefs, but I would submit that, yes, that interest simply doesn't exist when the communication is speak for itself. And honestly, that's sort of the point of footnotes.
So, taking your contextual approach and applying that to this particular paper, can you explain then why, okay, we would look then, what, at the timing of it, the fact that it only appears right before a particular ballot initiative is up for a vote, the fact that it refers to the ballot initiative 70-plus times, the fact that it identifies, well, in this particular instance, a Republican agenda and candidates who have espoused the opposite view, wouldn't that be part of then that contextual analysis, and would it not lead perhaps to the same conclusion that all of this is about an exhortation to vote against a particular ballot initiative, even if we look beyond the simple paragraph at the end?
I would say no for a few reasons.
Okay.
Walk me through. One is that the MCFL board didn't look at things that way.
Well, you're saying that it looked throughout the paper and said, well, there's lots of express advocacy,
yes,
it says over and over again, vote for, and here we just have it once. But if we're talking about similar synonyms.
No, sure. It's an excellent question. And again, this is difficult to rest with. I think the answer is, again, this question of there's a real danger that was identified in Buckley and subsequent opinions, that when you put a piece of communication out there, and again, I think we're talking about ads, but when you put a communication out there, you know, you're in some ways at the mercy of the listener or the reader or whatever else, if unless the standard is objective. So, for one thing, I don't think that attempts to get at the intention of the speaker based on these contextual contexts is constitutional.
Isn't that exactly what the contextual approach would ask us to do? I mean,
no, I don't think so.
Okay, then explain the difference.
Because again, in some ways, I feel like I'm arguing the inverse of the actual law. Right? The actual law is we have all these protections because we're dealing with the First Amendment, we're dealing with free speech. That does not mean that suddenly the burden is on the speaker to show.
No, I recognize that. I'm just trying to understand, okay, I'm taking, mm-hmm, you know, at face value, your suggested approach that we apply a contextual view to the entire document. So how do we do that?
Yeah, I understand the confusion. When I say a contextual view, what I'm arguing or suggesting to the court is the context of the express advocacy, not the context of the communication. Looking beyond the four corners of communication, I think would clearly be a problem.
Okay.
And there's no basis in Colorado law for doing that.
And my response then is still looking at the four corners of the document and what it contains.
And again, I think the standard has to be whether or not a reasonable person could view the overall communication as issue speech. And I think that's clearly the case here. And I do encourage this court to read the paper.
I have.
Excellent. So, I mean, in that context, I would say that, yes, a reasonable person could note that this is clearly issue speech. And again, you know, Buckley foresees this case. I mean, the fact that it's never been litigated doesn't mean that it's not there. I mean, Buckley says, yes, it is true that this distinction will collapse in practice, but that doesn't mean that we can break the ties in favor of government regulation. We break them the other way. And we know that when people discuss issues, I mean, and Buckley is in some ways perfect, right? Because Buckley's talking about candidates. But here it's even worse. I mean, whether or not there's a particular, you know, ballot initiative on the First Amendment, the person who is questioned as a policy question is constantly before the voters in Colorado. It's constantly in the air. It's constantly something that's being discussed. Yep. My client is still writing the paper, despite there not being a ballot issue.
And is it publishing this paper, despite there not being a ballot?
It's in the record that that's their intention, and I can say to the court that that is their intention.
What about the fundraising piece of this? What about the fundraising piece, that this is a separate product for which funds are raised to disseminate it and thereby influence voters?
Well, I think a few things on this. One is that you just don't get to that question unless this is express advocacy. But assuming it is, that I think is a question of whether or not this is like the special edition of MCFL. I think the secretary is correct on that. This is the concern of the majority or, you know, the plurality and the controlling opinion in MCFL. This idea that once you go down the road of regulating speech too broadly, suddenly the organizations that engage in speech have to worry about how they handle their funding, you know, how they make themselves the organization. I mean, part of the difficulty listening to the Secretary's arguments today is, you know, only a lawyer could think that you're actually giving bright line guidance to people by saying, if you have a single sentence, you're in trouble. And part of the reason I come back to that, despite Your Honor's point on the funding, is that it stems from it. You know, the more like a political committee and organization it is, the more likely it is to know these rules, the more likely it is to be careful about facts. Like, oh, apparently if I send out a solicitation for this particular paper, or I tell my friends that I'd like to write this paper, but, you know, it's going to take a lot of time and I'd like to be compensated. No, that's suddenly going to have constitutional relevance if we decide whether or not, you know, to get to this court. You know, I think that the Secretary's conceded that on press extension issue, that the major activities of the Coalition for Secular Government are press. And this clearly stems from that mission. And the fact that amateurs in the political process who thought they were engaged in protected issue speech didn't precisely fund their speech in the way the state would prefer cannot be what this riot's involved in. And I see my time's expired unless there are additional questions. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Pickleson. The case will be submitted on the briefs. We appreciate the arguments of both attorneys as well as your briefs. And we'll turn, unless there's objection by the court, my colleagues, to the second case on the 22nd recess. You wait. Session. We have Harlan Berkset versus Ring Loofborough in the ICAO office, case number 2011 SC 926. Case is set for argument for 30 minutes, 15 minutes per side. Are both parties ready? A couple of quick housekeeping matters. I know you both were here in the first argument. One, please make sure you tell us who you are when you start your argument. Two, the petitioner will have to keep track of your time. And three, we're using iPads, which have our notes and our briefs that are linked to Westlaw, so we're not emailing or surfing while you're arguing. I want you to know that. Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Margaret Keck, and I represent the employer and the insurer in this workers' compensation case. I would like to refer to my clients as the respondents. If I may, I'd also like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You have to keep track of your time, Ms. Kay.
Today, I wish to discuss two points. First, how the procedure in this workers' compensation case worked and how it should have worked but for interference by the administrative law judge in the Court of Appeals. And second, why the Court of Appeals decision has unnecessarily and severely degraded the statutorily mandated division IME process, not only for this case, but for all open workers' compensation cases. I'd like to comment at the very start that the Court of Appeals decision in this case sets a very dangerous precedent. It opens the door on all open claims, both lost time and non-lost time claims, to award temporary disability benefits after the date of maximum medical improvement without setting aside the treating physician's determination of maximum.
Ms. Keck, I'm sorry to interrupt you. You only have a couple of minutes. You both dispute in your briefs whether or not this case is open. Whether or not it's an open case. There's a dispute, yep. As I read it, and I'm just not clear. Why are you saying it's open? You say it was open because of the ALJ decision, but if you could just explain that.
Yeah. Well, the law states that when a case has been closed and reopened, a judge can start anew with determining whether a claim is at maximum, entitled to temporary disability benefits without regard to what happened in the case previously. So it's important to know whether we're dealing with an open or a closed case. And in this case, it was open because Ms. Lucero made a claim, and from that point in time it was open until it's closed. The statute doesn't define an open case, but it defines when a case becomes closed. So anything that isn't closed is therefore an open case.
Well, I thought you were arguing something very specific about Judge Felton's decision that made it open. Is that wrong?
I wasn't.
Okay.
The fact that the case is open is important only because the law is different for open cases and closed cases
that
are being
that
reopened.
Part. Okay. Thank you.
Well, I'm still confused. Well, the employer never admitted or stipulated in any way that maximum medical improvement had occurred. Is that right?
Correct.
Does that make a difference or not?
No.
Why not?
This case is in its infancy. What happened was Ms. Lucero reported she injured her back on the job, and then she proceeded to get medical treatment without filing a workers' compensation claim. The employer provided that medical treatment. The law does not require the insurer or the employer to state a position at that time on liability for the claim.
Okay.
If she had wanted to contest it, she was placed at maximum medical improvement only a month after she sustained the injury. She hadn't missed any time from work. If she had wanted to contest her placement at maximum medical improvement at that time or any subsequent time, she could have done so simply by filing a workers' claim for compensation. That claim, when she filed, would trigger a respondent's obligation to state a position on liability. If they accepted liability, it would have then triggered their obligation to file a final admission of liability based on the fact that the treating physician had